From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Mary Beth Maziarz. Today we speak first with author and EMT Joanna Sokol about her new book, A Real Emergency, Stories from the Ambulance, that offers a unique view into the poignant, frustrating, and sometimes ridiculous experiences faced by EMTs as they fill a critical but often under-recognized need in our medical system. Joanna's insights, humor, and humanity are both illuminating and inspiring as she shares details about the highlights and heartbreaks that she's experienced as an emergency medical responder. Then, award-winning author Jill Bielowski will talk to us about The End is the Beginning, her new memoir that begins with her mother's final days and circles all the way back to her birth in a deeply personal look into the tragedies and resilience that made her mother so extraordinary. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life. Stay with us. Welcome to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. All over the country, no matter where you are, who you are, or what your problem is, you can dial a 3-digit phone number and a group of trained professionals will show up at your current location right now to do their very best to help you with whatever's going on. Our next guest, Joanna Sokol, is one of those trained professionals, and she has seen it all. Sokol has worked on a 911 ambulance for 10 years along the beach in Santa Cruz, in the high desert of Reno, and on the steep streets of San Francisco. Before that, she spent time as a ski patroller, wilderness EMT, and medical standby for raves and music festivals. And now she's gathered her experiences and stories from other medical professionals in a new book called A Real Emergency, Stories from the Ambulance. It's been called a love letter from a paramedic to the best and worst parts of her career. Joanna Sokol, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So you write, as a street medic, I'm never going to see most patients' lab values, but I'll see the inside of their bedroom. I see moldy kitchens, rotted attics. I leave food out for pets, switch off lights, turn down the stove under a pot of oxtails. Once I read half a poem left in a dead woman's typewriter. We call it the scene. Is the scene safe? What is the scene like? You get a much fuller picture of the patient's lives than they can provide on an intake form. You get a window into their environments, their relationships, their mental state, their hopes and regrets. Do you find this helps you or haunts you? And are the doctors and medical professionals at the destinations interested in this information, or is this something you just carry with you?
Yeah, what a great question. Does it help me or haunt me? Definitely both. Absolutely both. Because we get a really intimate picture of patients' lives. We're only with each patient for somewhere between, 30, 45 minutes, maybe an hour or two. But we see this really, really intimate window. Like I said, we look in their closets, we go in their fridge for medication and we see what they've been eating that week. We see the clothes they wear and the pictures on the walls. And when we get to the hospital, you asked if the doctors and nurses rely on that information. And it's a really interesting question. Sometimes they'll ask us quickly, what was the house like? And we get maybe 30 seconds to say, yeah, it was okay. Or, yeah, it was a little bit rough. But that's pretty much it. We really don't get a lot of time during that handoff interaction to tell them, there were 5 cats running around and they were urinating on the floor. And then the cousin stopped by and left a rum bottle on the table. And there were some empty, there's these really vivid pictures of patients' lives that we get in just a couple of minutes. And we get, when we hand off our patient at the hospital, we get like maybe 5 minutes, sometimes less than that, to explain to the nurse or doc what happened, because they're in a hurry also. They have a lot of patients, they have a lot to do. And so we give a quick report, this is Mrs. Smith, she's had a tummy ache for 4 days, here's her symptoms, here's her meds. And so a lot of the time that information about their life and their house and their family and their pets just kind of stays with us. And that was one of the things I really wanted to write about, because I had all these images of people's lives and of what it feels like to go into people's homes and carry that around with you. And they started to feel really heavy after a while. It felt like I was carrying around all of these details about people's lives and their experiences with me. And I felt like I needed to put it somewhere, do something with it. So that's one of the things that inspired me to write the book.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I think we all see medical shows, like we're imagining the team from House MD going to the house to like suss out what are the real issues here driving their medical drama, but
Yeah,
in
which, to
real
my
life.
knowledge, I don't think any doctor has ever done in the history of medicine. But paramedics do that. We will absolutely search around a patient's house, like House MD style, and look in their closets and try to figure out what's going on with them.
That's great. Well, there's so much to talk about in this book. I had no idea it was going to be such a multifaceted read. I mean, it's hilarious and it is moving and it is just really informative too. Like one of the things I learned that I did not know was that when you arrive at the hospital with a patient, you're rarely ushered straight to a room, and that you, as a paramedic, often wait with the patients for hours sometimes until a nurse has time to take over. What is that time like? It must be just this
Yeah.
weird middle ground.
I'm laughing a little bit because if there's one thing that I just want to shout from the rooftops right now, anytime someone gives me a microphone, I start screaming about triage delays or wall times, as we call them. And the reason we call it wall time is because, as you mentioned, in the movies, we show up and we go straight to a room and we drop off the patient. It's all really dramatic. And in real life, what happens 9 times out of 10, for the record, if our patient is like in cardiac arrest, if we're doing CPR, if they've been shot a bunch of times, we get to go straight to your room. But for 90% of our patients, we show up at the hospital and the nurse says, "Hey, we're really busy, grab a wall." And then what we do, and what she means by that, is we literally take the gurney and we physically pull it up next to the wall in the hallway. And then we wait there for 45 minutes, an hour, 3 hours, until the hospital has a bed open up that they can give us. And it's a bananas use of resources, right? We've got a fully stocked, fully staffed ambulance in a city that's really understaffed, just sitting on the wall of a hospital, babysitting their patient for them. And a lot of the time we've got calls popping off outside. We've got a radio like, "Can anyone clear? Can anyone clear? We've got a cardiac arrest. We've got a pediatric patient." And those calls are waiting for ambulances because half the ambulances in the city are pulled up on the wall, just like dealing with hospital understaffing issues. So it's great. Yes, I will yell about this all the time. To answer your question, what's that like? It's really boring. Because these are generally stable patients, patients who have like a tummy ache, or they twisted their ankle, or they've got, constipation or diabetes complications, something that's making them sick. They need a hospital visit, but they're not really in a hurry. And it's really frustrating. It's really, really anger-inducing to sit there as a paramedic with your partner. So there's two of you on this patient, and listen to calls popping off on your radio and know that your city is desperate for ambulances to clear, but you're hanging out at a hospital and you chat with your patient, you make sure they're comfortable. And then after a while, you kind of run out of things to talk about and you get on your phone and start playing, Candy Crush for like several hours. And you take turns using the bathroom, or sometimes you walk back to the rig and have a snack real quick. One of you has to stay with the patient. And you watch the hospital going about its business. And every time a nurse comes by, you try desperately to make eye contact and wave at her. And she just like doesn't look at you and keeps walking because, they don't have time to deal with you either. They're incredibly busy and understaffed. It's not the nurse's fault. They're just the ones that we like to blame because they're the messenger. So yeah, it's incredibly frustrating. And I will tell anyone who will listen all about it.
And is that, I mean, I'm sure there are many angles to it, but is that managed healthcare trying to maximize profits? Like, it doesn't seem like a great use of resources. You do bring up a lot
Put
of
it
great
lightly.
things about the medical system to consider in your book also.
It's like a weird side effect of the way that hospitals and ambulances are set up right now. And I want to mention that this isn't just a problem in the systems I worked in. It's a really big problem nationally. It's also a really big problem in Canada right now. It's huge. You can look it up. There's other countries that are struggling with this. It's not just a local issue in some places. So to get into the why, there's a really well-intentioned series of laws passed back in the 70s about patient abandonment and about emergency care. And they basically say that when we've got somebody who's in an emergency, a doctor at the hospital has to stabilize them before they're allowed to kick that patient out onto the street. It's really well-intentioned. It actually originally came out of pregnant mothers who were getting turfed by hospitals to go to a cheaper hospital where they're folks who didn't have insurance. But what it means is that we're not allowed to just ditch patients at the hospital. I can't go to the hospital, tip the gurney over, drop off the patient and go take another one. I have to wait until a doctor can take over care. And so if there's no doctors available, I just got to wait. And the hospitals are also really understaffed, and we can rant about why that's taking place. But I try not to get into that because my specialty is really the emergency side of it. But yeah, so until the doctor has time to officially take over care, I'm not allowed to abandon my patient.
I think I read in your book also that law applies when you're answering calls as well. Like some people who are frequent flyers or just people who maybe are down on their luck or very lonely or have a need for human connection are calling 911, but you're not allowed to say, sorry, we've got more important calls to take. You do need to follow up on each one. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my favorite parts of my job is that we don't check people's credit card number and insurance before we run calls. Anyone can call us, literally anyone. You don't have to have a credit card. You don't have to have insurance. You don't have to have like good standing with the ambulance company. You don't even have to have what people would consider to be a real emergency. You can call for anything and we'll still show up. We'll go up, we'll talk to you, we'll make sure you're okay. But what that means is we have a huge number of patients calling us over and over and over again for their sprained toe, for their headache because they're lonely. You know, I think of one guy who we all know, we have a nickname for him. I mean, we have a lot of regulars, every system do, but he would call us four or five times a day just because he was feeling lonely and sad. And he was a really severe alcoholic. He would drink a lot. He would get sad. He would cry. And then he would call 911 and we would show up and we would say, hey buddy, how's it going? We were just here 45 minutes ago. You know, but I'm not allowed to just tell him to F off. I gotta go every time. And if he wants to go to the hospital, I have to take him. I'm not allowed to say no. Paramedics aren't allowed to take on that liability. If he wants a ride to the ER that just kicked him out, you know, 10 minutes ago and he took the bus down the street and then called us back, I have to take him back to that same ER again. And then I have to wait in line to get him a bed. And the ER is not going to make him a priority.
No, they're not.
They just evaluated him and kicked him out an hour ago. And so then we're back in this cycle where we're waiting on him. And so it's incredibly frustrating. And all of it is just these really messed up symptoms and side effects of really well-intentioned laws. You know, we want to be able to help everybody. And unfortunately, not everybody has a really like clean, easily fixable, dramatic medical complaint.
It's not all a compound fracture that just needs to go away.
Exactly. Not every on TV, the patients are always so sympathetic. You know, they're always these really nice, really sympathetic people who have like a really dramatic medical complaint. and that's just not what it is in real life. And one of the things I wanted to talk about in the book was how complicated that is. You know, it's really beautiful. It's really messed up. It's really frustrating. It can be really hilarious. You know, we have moments of like real silliness when we're just talking to these patients and they're drunk and we're kind of talking crap to each other because we know each other so well. You know, we're telling dirty jokes, we're laughing, someone's fallen over and we're like, all right, man, let's get you into the hospital, you know?
Well, I thought about that a lot. I love medical dramas and I really, really liked The Pitt that came out past year. It was gripping. And you mentioned in the book, we arrive at the crisis point of a story and we almost never witness its resolution. And I feel like medical dramas are so satisfying because the viewers get to follow that whole trajectory from presentation to diagnosis to resolution, all in one neatly wrapped hour show. Do many or even any of the shows get it right about what you do?
Yeah, no, that's so insightful. And I'll tell you a secret. I actually love medical dramas too. I make a lot of fun of them in the book. But one of the reasons I make so much fun is that I've like seen them all. and they do, they wrap all of their storylines up so neatly. And people always say, oh, they should make TV shows about medics. You know, they should make a movie about this. It'd be so good. And I'm like, no, it'd be a terrible movie because we never get any resolution. Every single one of our patients, we get to know them. We see the inside of their home. We connect with them. We talk to them about this like incredibly emotional thing that's happening in their life. And then we drop them off and then we move on to the next one. And imagine if every episode of a medical drama, the patient would just get dropped off. And then it was like, oh, did that guy live or die? I don't know. We're on to the next one. You know, we have no idea. We don't get to find out. And that's one of the things that really wears on you.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're talking with author Joanna Sokol about her new book, A Real Emergency, Stories from the Ambulance. Well, Joanna, when you were getting your EMT certification, you write that you thought it would be getting paid to lean out of a helicopter and say, don't worry, ma'am, we've got you now. How often do you actually get that kind of adrenaline rush situation that most of us imagine makes up the job?
Right? Almost never.
oh, no.
We almost never get those really dramatic, like life-saving. We do get those like exciting Hollywood moments every once in a while. But 95% of the job, we're working with the elderly. We're working with the homeless. We're working with people who have mental health issues and chronic issues and call us really frequently, or people who have like a really basic medical complaint. They need a primary care physician. But I don't know if you've tried to get an appointment with a primary care doctor lately. Even if you have insurance, they're like, okay, we've got something free next November, you know? And so they call us instead. And we go, we help them out with their meds. We help them figure out how to take care of a kid with a fever, you know, or somebody that needs stitches. The vast majority of the job is really, really just everyday medical and social complaints of people who don't have someone else to call. And it's really hard as a young paramedic or a young EMT because it's not what you're taught in school. It's not what you're taught to expect. You know, we learn to fix breathing and open the airway and stop bleeding. And then you get out to school and somebody is like, or sorry, you get out of school, you run your first call and somebody's like, yeah, this is Grandma Millie. The doc said we're supposed to take the blue pills, but then we got them filled and they're all yellow and we don't know which ones are the pills that she's supposed to take, you know, and Grandma Millie's got dementia, so you can't really ask her. And you're like, no one's bleeding to death. What am I supposed to do? And so it's really challenging as a medic. There's a big struggle. There is beauty in it. If you can manage to wrap your head around the fact that this is the job that you're supposed to do, not that other thing that they talked about in school, there's actually a lot of beauty and there's a lot of honor in it, in being like, these are the people, they don't have anyone else to call. I'm not really trained for this. I'm not equipped for it. I don't have the right tools, but I'm here and I'm going to try my best to help you out. So there's a lot of honor in it if you can manage to deal with the frustration that it takes to get through your day.
I bet. And there's a lot of honor in it from those of us who appreciate your services too. Is there something that you've discovered that helps you hold on to the humanity in the situation? Because I imagine there are things that could make you jaded or break your heart or, yeah, you know, kind of leave you adrift with the human condition.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a term that's really trendy right now in mental health stuff, compassion fatigue. And it's very real. Anyone who does this job long enough is going to start to feel their compassion drain and their cynicism grow. We all get really, really tired and you get days where you just cannot find your compassion anymore. It just feels like it's off, you know, someone's calling you and they're looking at you with like fear in their eyes and you just don't care. Like you can't, and you're like, I should care about this. I really should, you know, this person's in real pain, but you just don't because you've been doing it all day, every day for 10 years, and you just don't have anything left. The first draft of my book, it wasn't even really a draft. It was just like all of my thoughts. And I was trying to sort of figure out what I was going to talk about. And I had my mom read it. Cause you know, we're really close. She helps me with my writing. And she said, Joe, nobody's going to read your book if it's 300 pages of cynicism and diarrhea.
I got to say, I think your mom is right.
But I was so burned out. I was so angry at the system and the companies that were messing with us and the people and the system and the bureaucracy. I was so angry. And so I had to go back and I had to find my compassion. I had to find the, remember the funny stories. And you asked what it was that helps you keep your humanity. And the answer is actually really easy. It's the other people that you work with. It's the camaraderie, hands down. The medics and nurses and doctors and the mentors that I worked with absolutely keep you going. Instead of writing about patients and people's tragedy, I realized I wanted to write about this group of people that I was doing the work with. And like, who is it that does this work? And why do they do the work? And how do they keep going? And that's when the book actually really started to grow and get more interesting. I started to read a ton of history of like how ambulances came to be. I started to interview other EMTs and paramedics. And I have testimonials in the book from other people that I've worked with. And I have, it's not like a comprehensive history, but I reach back. I found a bunch of stories from like the horse and buggy days and from the 60s and 70s. And of the people who like tried to figure out what an ambulance was even going to be and how it was going to work. And that was when the book really started to take shape in my head. And I was like, this isn't actually just going to be about me and my stories. It's going to be about the medics and the EMTs and like the people that do this work and how they keep their humanity and how we continue to show up.
It really is a book about connection and being willing to show up to connect with a person from a call or your compatriots in the dregs and all these things. And keeping that connection is just so invaluable.
Yeah, I love that. The connections from other EMTs and medics is just like, it is the thing that ended up mattering the most to me in the long run. And that's been a really cool thing about seeing the book come out. I was really nervous how the people I work with are going to take it, you know, whether it was going to be like, oh, who does she think she is, you know, writing about, but it's been the exact opposite. People are actually really stoked to see somebody kind of putting the word out about what the job's really like and what we're doing, you know, and that's why I love ranting about wall times. I love talking about how this isn't the Hollywood version of it, because all the people that I work with are like, yeah, no, go on the radio, tell them that, you know, tell the whole world about it. That I actually feel like I kind of managed to tap a nerve, you know, that they've been really excited. They want me to go like tell the world about what the job is really like. And so it's actually been really fun. It's been really overwhelming.
Well, we're talking a lot right now about some of the issues with the medical system, but a lot of the book is really entertaining and has some very, very funny and moving stories. What was a really absurd situation that you think about from your experiences?
Yeah, one of my favorites, and I tell this story a lot, and I feel really bad for the guy now because I tell the story so often, but it was such a funny, absurd situation. He had gotten really drunk with his friends. They were trying to recreate the Jackass videos. I don't know if I'm allowed to.
How many calls have been driven by that show?
Right? I don't know if I'm allowed to say Jackass on the radio, but... And so he poured a whole bottle of hot sauce all over his genital region, which it turns out causes pretty severe chemical burns. And so the guy was in very real pain. His pain was actually very real. But when we showed up, he was buck naked on the street in the middle of this like cute little cul-de-sac. And his neighbor was this middle-aged guy who looked really sort of annoyed more than anything and was spraying him down with a hose while the kid was just sitting there writhing and screaming. And the neighbor was the funniest part, because when we got there and it's an absurd scene. You know, you've got this naked kid screaming on the ground. You've got the neighbor just casually spraying him with a hose. Nobody else was out. And as soon as we got there, the neighbor kind of looked at us and was like, all right, we good here? And just turned off the hose and walked inside. Just like no acknowledgement of what was going on. And then we were dealing with this kid who was in a lot of very real pain. And we took him in the ambulance and we transported him. But when people talk about absurdity, it really is, that image is one of the first things that comes to mind. And I think always will, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to pull that one out of my brain.
Well, I have two teenage boys. And so I shared that story with them, lest they ever be inspired to do something so ridiculous.
Yeah. No, his pain was very real.
Well, in the same way that shows like Sunday Morning and podcasts like This American Life offer gripping and entertaining glimpses into life's moments, your book, A real emergency, stories from the ambulance, stokes sympathy, laughter, and humanity with its stories and reflections. Joanna, we can't thank you enough for being on The Mountain Life with us this morning.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. That was a wonderful interview.
Good luck with the book. I hope people find it and love it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Anyone who's grieved the death of a parent or really experienced a deep loss of anyone we've loved knows that the aftermath can bring a flood of questions and reflection as we try to make sense of these endings, and in some cases, even their beginnings. And though grief is an inherently solo experience, the journeys of others can often help us find moments of solace, familiarity, and resonance as we make our way through it. In her new book, The End is the Beginning, A Personal History of My Mother, author Jill Bielowski dissects the many facets of her mother Iris's life, from Iris's decline and death in a care home all the way back through the eras of her life. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geraldine Brooks called Bielowski's book an atonement, a brave and eloquent assessment of a life battered by loss and ennobled by resilience. We're honored to have you on the program. Jill Bielowski, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Oh, thank you so much. So glad to be here.
Well, let's just start with the beginning. The title, The End of the Beginning, feels so layered and poignant, as well as being an accurate description of the way you structured the book. How did you arrive at that phrase and format?
Yes, thank you, Mary Beth. It felt as if it was quite organic because when my mother passed away, it was during the first month of COVID in March of 2020. And if you remember, there were so many restrictions about travel, and I was in New York and she was in Cleveland, and I was not able to be with her in her final days when she was in hospice, and I wasn't able to attend the graveside funeral. And that left me feeling quite unable to fully process what was happening. I did witness the funeral via FaceTime with my sister when she was in Cleveland. And I wrote, after that experience, which was so surreal, I wrote a piece about it for the New York Times. And that was the beginning for me when I realized that I wanted to write about my mother's life and try to process who she was to me. And so I thought by writing the book from the end to the beginning, I would be able to kind of gradually, through these pivotal moments in her life, bring her alive for me. And the title comes from a T.S. Eliot poem, The Four Quartets. I came across this poem, which I had known when I was at the T.S. Eliot house, actually working on this book, and I was reading the Four Quartets, and I came across these three lines that I use as the epigraph to the book. What we call the beginning is often the end, and to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. So that was an epiphany for me, and I decided that I would call my book The End is the Beginning. And T.S. Eliot's conceit is that at the end of our lives is also the beginning of our lives, that we always hold within us our early selves, which made sense as I was discovering more about my mother outside of being my mother, if you will.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
beautiful. Well, family memoir is so interesting because it kind of tells two stories, doesn't it? The one we're encouraged to believe by those around us when we're growing up, and the one we discover or interpret on our own, often many years later with the help of more mature understanding and far more information. Did you find that the paths of your family story were very at odds with each other as you worked through your mother's life?
Yes, that's a great question. Beginning of the book is very much my own memories of my mother and you know, being together with her and the way in which she impacted my life in these pivotal moments that I narrate. But when I got to the part of her life when I wasn't born yet, which was really interesting for me to recall her early marriage and her younger years in high school and junior high, and then her early days with her father and mother. I realized that she was so shaped by her childhood and by those early years, and it made me see her in a very different way. So, you know, we have these ideas about who our parents are, who we are, but sometimes we have to go a little deeper to discover, you know. In the book, I recall that when my mother was 8 years old, she had a very close relationship to her own mother and her father, and they came from a very modest upbringing in Cleveland, Ohio, where I was born. And when my mother was 9 years old, her mother became pregnant. And then during the pregnancy, she caught scarlet fever, which at that time there were no antibiotics and it was very contagious. And when she went into labor, she sadly passed away, and my mother's brother lived through it. And so I recognized, writing that section of the book, what a deep loss that must have been for my mother. And I was thinking about how that informed her own adulthood and her own parenting. I suppose that by writing about her life, I felt even closer to the real essence of who she was outside of being my mother. I suppose that's what I hope that this book will give readers, is a kind of thinking about what shaped their own parents' lives and how that may have affected their parenting. And of course, you know, who we are because of our families.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, isn't it? When you're able to slowly start diverging your idea of your mom as your mom from your mom as a person and her own individual life. Because as a child, there's no way to do that. But as an adult, it really does inform a lot of things about their behaviors and some of the decisions they made and things. It must have been really interesting. How did you compile the information about these different eras of your mom's life when you weren't around yet?
Well, that did require, first of all, my mother used to tell me stories about her family and about her childhood. And after her mother died, my grandfather's sisters came in and helped. And they were, of course, a big part of my life. So they were my great aunt. So I knew them very well. And my mother was a collector of sorts. And she collected, she kept scrapbooks of her days in junior high and high school, where she was very popular, and I could see who she was in through these scrapbooks. They were very detailed about the dates that she went on, her sororities and her clubs. And also she kept family photo albums. And those were very helpful. And then, you know, I had to rely on my narrative skills as a novelist to kind of create the story. And I did research into the time period and into the community, which helped to bring alive the, you know, the milieu in which she grew up, where women were brought up to be really wives and mothers and married very early. My mother married when she was 21. And so I felt like I had in my head enough once I did all that research to sort of tell certain stories.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're talking with author Jill Bielowski about her new book, The End of the Beginning, A Memoir of Grief and Love. In revisiting the past through your various sources and the scrapbooks, did you uncover any memories or details about your family that surprised you or really shifted your perspective about the way you understood things?
I think that when I was writing about the time in my mother's life when she was raising young children on her own, one of the biggest, aside from losing her mother, another very tragic thing happened to my mother that I write about, that she, when she was newly married and very in love and just beginning her life as a wife and a mother, they gradually had three daughters And when my mother was 25 and my father was 30, my father died suddenly of a heart attack. And my mother had three young girls to raise on her own under the age of three. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I always knew that. I was 2 years old when my father died, but writing about what that must have been like for my mother really hit home for me, you know, how she did that, because I have one son and I remember, you know, and a husband who was very much a part of raising our son. And I just couldn't imagine how my mother did it and how completely this idea of who she was, a wife and a mother, and what she wanted, what she thought her future would be, was suddenly altered inexplicably. And I think that I recognized how fortunate I was in a way that I came of age in the time in which women were to be independent and to have a life and a career of my own, because I saw how difficult that was for my mother, that she did not have the skills and training and education that I was able to have. So I think that that too really was something that hit home more deeply as I was narrating that story.
I'm sure.
If that makes sense to you.
Oh, it does. And
yes.
And just the compassion that arises when you truly can wrap your head around, maybe for the first time, some of the experiences that somebody went through, that as you're growing up, again, you don't consider those things and you just don't know them. They don't talk about them as much. And identifying with that in that different way must have been really powerful.
Yes, it's really, when you're younger, you're just living your life, right? You're just living it, but you're not necessarily able to look back and reflect.
Yeah. Well, what challenges did you face in balancing the roles of mourning and being a mother yourself and writing? You know, sometimes actively living is quite different from the practice of observing and interpreting that's such a part of writing.
Yes, that's true, Mary Beth. You know, I've come to think about, like, the act of writing is really almost like a secret language that, I mean, I'm living my life in the sense of getting up in the morning and getting breakfast and doing my duties. And then when I tunnel into my own writing, it really is like entering another world. And yes, the two can sometimes create a little bit of havoc in the mind. But I really do feel grateful that I have the ability to, you know, to use my writing to tell stories that I hope will be meaningful to the readers that have similar experiences but haven't fully, you know, when you read a book that reflects your own experience, it's always that wonderful feeling, you know, that books can offer companionship. At least they do for me. I'm such an avid reader. And, you know, when you hit on a book that really touches you, it's almost like having a conversation with your best friend, or even better sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and grief is such a dramatically nonlinear process. In your book, when you alternate between memory and dream and daily life in that kind of nonlinear narrative, it felt so accurate. Just like that's real rhythm of grief, is that it's not step by step. And we all know about Kubler-Ross's the stages of grief, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. There are so many nooks and crannies of grief that I don't think people talk about. And reading your book, The End of the Beginning, it made me think a lot about my reflections since my father died. We just had the seventh anniversary of his death a couple days ago, and how the timbre of the feelings of grief change so much. And sometimes they are wrenching and other times they're beautiful. How did your background as a poet influence the structure and language of this book? Because there are such beautiful passages in it that I don't think I expected as I took on reading a book about grief.
Yes, grief is a mysterious instrument. it comes and goes. You know, I feel that sometimes it comes in big waves and really hits you, and other times it comes in bittersweet ways where you remember, you know, I'll be setting the table, for instance, and I'll remember how my mother taught me where the silverware goes and where the glass goes, and I'll have such a visual memory of her, and it will make me feel joy in a way, just to have those memories. I wrote a piece about grief is a forever thing in the New York Times, and that's the way that I think about it, that, you know, obviously when you lose somebody, there's that acute grief that is shock, and you're trying to, your body and mind is trying to absorb this monumental thing that the person that you are so deeply connected to isn't there anymore in the same way, only in memory. And then, you know, I don't think it ever fully passes, right? I mean, that there are moments where it comes back, like an anniversary, as you recalled. And those can be very, I find, very challenging sometimes. I think as a poet, I began writing poetry when I was in college and reading a lot of poetry. And I took a poetry workshop. And I remember that the poet who was my professor poet told us, and I was 18 at the time, that along with the craft lessons that we were given about how to compose a poem and the elements of metaphor and language and so forth, in terms of the subject matter, he said to write about what hurts. And that really has remained in my vocabulary. So as a young poet, I began writing about the loss of my father, which I hadn't really fully absorbed what that meant for me. It was more what it meant for my mother. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very glad that I began writing as a poet, because I learned certain skills and how to use language to speak to what is kind of unsayable, right? That we sometimes don't have the words for, but somehow through language, I could find them to echo reverberations of emotion and loss and joy too.
Yeah.
Joy can come from grief.
Yeah. Well, speaking to that, what role does silence or what's left unsaid play throughout your book?
That's a beautiful question, Mary Beth. And I guess that I love that you asked that question, because isn't that, I suppose, what one's words create to the reader? That is kind of astonishing for me to think about, because you never quite know what your story will evoke in a reader. So I think that you're right, that that's all in the white spaces, that happens, you know, when you close a book too and think about it. And what you remember of a book. I used to feel that the most significant books were the ones that stayed with me after I stopped reading them, and years later would remember scenes from a book that really still lived in my consciousness. So yes, I love thinking about the white space.
I do too. I love to ask this question of writers, but would you describe a little bit about your process of how you write?
Mm-hmm. I like to work toward getting a full draft out so that I have a structure for the book that then I can go back and fill in more through several different drafts and sort of be able to identify the chronology of the book more clearly in my mind and have markers that I know I need to fill or change. So I'm always sort of going toward getting the rhythm first, getting the voice and getting the rhythm. And once I have that, I gain the confidence that this is actually could possibly work, because you never know when you undertake a project if it is going to work in the way that you want it to. So I think that's my process, that something is really calling to me to tell a particular story, and then I have to figure out how to do it.
Yeah, you reflect in the book even on what it means to preserve someone's memory without letting it define you. Did your whole idea of your mother, is that different having written this book than it was before, mm-hmm. or is it just expanded upon?
I think through writing the book, I had always had empathy for my mother's experience. And, you know, some of her tragedies and experiences were difficult for me as a child, because I saw some of her suffering, and there were periods in her life where she suffered from depression. And it was hard. I didn't fully understand what was going on. Of course, she had reasons to be depressed. And I think in writing the book, I just felt more compassion for her, outside of, again, being my mother. Just, you know, we go through life and we're trying to live our own lives, but if we're a mother, we also have these responsibilities to our child. And so it made me see her more clearly, that perhaps there were things I wanted more from her as a daughter, but I realized that she didn't have that in her at times. So I think I would say the biggest feeling I had after writing about her was just, I found her to be so heroic. Mm. And I had not seen her that way in my life. And yeah, it was, you know, she went through the loss in, you know, people who read the book will see that, you know, losing her mother, her husband, and then she lost a daughter, the youngest daughter from a second marriage. And that's a lot.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot.
So she was heroic in the way in which she dealt with that, and also did find ways of connecting with people and with life too. Mm. So yeah, I think my story is very much about, you know, living through loss and grief.
Your mother suffered from dementia at the end of her life, mm-hmm. as well, right? Did you find that there was a part of you that was almost pre-grieving as she started to slip away in that way that people with dementia do?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that for me, when she was first diagnosed, I had no idea really about what would come in the years that the disease, you know, slowly takes hold and one loses gradually their cognitive abilities in ways that I just never could have imagined. And I think that the feeling that I always had and that I write about in my book is this idea of wanting to preserve her dignity as much as possible, because there are still very vital parts of themselves that are still there. It's just that they may not have the ability when you lose some language abilities, you're not able to express yourself. I could tell by the way that my mother would interact when I was there, just by her facial expressions or her laugh, that she was there in some way. And I wanted to be able to preserve as much dignity as possible as the disease progressed. It is a loss.
Yeah.
To experience. I think I felt that writing about those years, I did have an epiphany that maybe it was harder for me in some ways than for my mother.
Absolutely.
I thought about that a great deal, about dignity and being able to communicate with the sufferer as a real person. Sometimes people can infantilize.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I was gradually losing her in some ways in that process.
Well, we've been talking with Jill Bielowski about her book, The End of the Beginning, A Memoir of Grief and Love. What do you hope readers will carry with them after reading The End of the Beginning, especially those who might be quietly carrying their own grief?
I think what I would like to say is just that, you know, there's such a deep bond that we have with our parents, and for me, obviously, my mother. And I would like readers to be able to recognize the power of that bond and the way in which it influences one's life. And, you know, I wish that I had even known more about my mother's early years than I did. So I suppose that, you know, to learn more about one's mother or father's upbringing in life, I think can be very illuminating. But I hope that my book shows the depth of the relationship and the ways in which love and grief inform all of our lives.
Jill, thank you so much for being with me on Mountain Life today.
Oh, thank you, Mary Beth. It's been a pleasure.